Okay, this is gonna be hard, I think. Okay, when we measure risk, we can measure as a proportion. However, due to ethical reasons, we cannot directly measure the proportion of sequelae if C. trachomatis infections are not detected and treated. Okay. Okay, so we essentially have to measure a period incidence, which is the risk of tubal damage over the period from X to Y in women with untreated chlamydia infection. It is important to remember, however, clinically we cannot directly measure tubal damage. Infertility and ectopic pregnancy may not be recognized only years later when women become trying to become pregnant. In review of the literature, we didn't find any prospective studies directly evaluate risk of long-term mobility following untreated chlamydia infection. There's a two set of longitudinal studies. Group one, these studies assess the proportion. What's going on? This set of studies assess the proportion of untreated chlamydia infection leading to PID. And the second group of study evaluate the proportion of PID cases leading to infertility and ectopic pregnancy. I'm also going to present the third group of study, which evaluate the risk of sequelae following repeated chlamydia infection. This slide shows three studies in group one. And all the studies assess the risk of PID in women with untreated chlamydia infection. The study by Stem et al. Is probably the most widely cited study. The study followed 20 high-risk women with both chlamydia and gonorrhea infection. These women received effective treatment for gonorrhea, but not for chlamydia. And six of the 20 women, or 30%, developed PID over a seven-week period. The study by Ryman et al. Had a longer duration of follow-up, and four of the 109 girls, or 3.7%, reported being hospitalized for self-pneumonitis or seen in the emergency room for lower abdominal pain and vaginal discharge. The study by Murray et al. Follows 30 women for as long as 1 year, and none developed PID. Please keep in mind, the later two studies was in relatively low-risk women with asymptomatic chlamydia infection. This table shows three additional studies. These studies are similar in that all three were conducted in high-risk settings, and the risk of PID was assessed over the roughly two-week period between testing and treatment. As you can see, the findings are very consistent, with PID rates from 2.0% to 4.5%. When these three studies are combined, there are 8 cases of PID out of a total of 275 women, and the overall rate is about 3%. So if the average rate observed in the two-week period between testing and treatment is assumed to be constant and to apply to all women with chlamydia, it would be expected that 18% of women would develop PID in 3 months and over 50% in 1 year. However, the best data regarding the risk of PID over longer period follow-up is probably from the POPPY trial in UK. At this point, we only have a preliminary data from this trial. We know that about 1,300 women were randomized to the control arm and had their vaginal swab stored. So this 75 women were not treated. But when they were analyzed at the end of 12 months later, 9% of the women developed chlamydia PID, PID of all causes. So 9% developed PID. So in summary, what is the risk of PID? In high-risk settings, 2 to 5% of untreated women develop PID within the two-week period between testing and treatment. 9% of relatively low-risk women with untreated asymptomatic chlamydia infection develop PID in 12 months. The risk of 30% reported by Stam et al. And the 0% by Murray are probably outliers. All these studies have limitations. The studies were all in women with a prevalent infection, so the timing of PID relative to the acquisition is unknown. Also, we know clinical diagnosis of PID have low specificity. Now let's look at the second group of studies, which assess what happens follow a diagnosis of PID. The Westrom study is the only study look at a tubal factor infertility instead of infertility for all causes. The sample size was large. In women with salpingitis confirmed by laparoscopy, 11% has tubal infertility, compared to 0% in women who had a clinical suspected PID, but with normal tubes. The risk of ectopic pregnancy was 9.1% and 1.4% respectively in the two groups. The study by Ness et al. Was a randomized trial known as the PEACH trial. This study is an important study for several reasons. First, the study was conducted in the late 1990s, so the PID cases were diagnosed based on the modern era diagnostic criteria, and all the women were treated with contemporary antibiotic regimens. Second, the study was conducted in persons more or less representing the population served by our STD control program, namely young women with relatively high risk. The study was also large. The risk of infertility was high, 18% over a three-year period. Another important finding from this study was that the long-term outcome was not different in women with treated as inpatient or outpatient. There are three additional studies in women following PID diagnosis. I list them here only for completeness, but I'm not going to go in detail. As you see, the study either have very limited, very small sample size or have other problems. As you know, clinical diagnosis of the PID can be of different and often complex infectious etiologies, including chlamydia, gonorrhea, and other pathogens. We want to know whether the risk of sequelae following clinical chlamydia PID differ from PID of other causes. Hillis et al. Study compared the risk of infertility following chlamydial and gonococcal PID, and they found no difference in the risk of impaired infertility. So this slide summarizes the risk of sequelae following PID. It is clear that PID of any cause is strongly associated with sequelae. Even with treatment, symptomatic PID is associated with significant long-term morbidity. In PEACH trial, 18% of women developed infertility following the episode of PID, and 0.6% had an ectopic pregnancy over approximately 3 years. Again, all these PID cases were diagnosed and treated using the modern era clinical guidelines. Now I have presented to you the two groups of studies. When we have data about the risk of symptomatic PID following a secretory comatous infection, and also the data about impaired infertility following symptomatic PID. By comparing these two groups of data, we can estimate the risk of sequelae, right? Yes, but the limitation of all the studies is that we don't know how much tubal damage occur outside of the pathway of a symptomatic PID. Subclinical tubal damage likely lead to some degree of infertility and other complications. We know this because many women with tubal factor infertility and ectopic pregnancy have not prior history of diagnosed PID. Okay, now let's examine the third group of studies. These studies assess the risk of PID and ectopic pregnancy in women with repeated chlamydia infection. Hillis et al. Reported the first large study assessed the risk of PID and the risk of ectopic pregnancy in women with different number of chlamydia episodes. The study used the ICD-9 codes of hospitalized discharges to ascertain cases of PID and ectopic pregnancy. For PID, the risk odds ratio was 4.0 and 6.4, respectively, in women with two and three or more episodes of chlamydia infection, compared to those with one infection. For ectopic pregnancy, the odds ratio was 2.1 and 4.5, respectively. The study by Bakken et al. Is a better study for two reasons. First, both inpatient and outpatient ectopic pregnancies were included. This study was in Norway and was a population-based study. A more important reason is that in this study, they adjust for parity. A time-dependent variable was used to adjust for the number of pregnancies that women have. As you can see, the relative risk of ectopic pregnancy was 0.58 per 100% year in women with one chlamydia infection compared to 1.39 in those with two or more episodes of chlamydia infection. The relative risk was 2.4. Lastly, the study by Kami et al. Followed urban sex workers in Kenya. This is a smaller study, but it included only chlamydia PID in this analysis. The odds ratio was 1.8, and it's after adjusting for many possible confounders, such as infection with gonorrhea and the use of a contraception. In summary, it is clear that repeat infection are likely to link to higher risk. The risk of both PID and ectopic pregnancy are at least doubled in women with two or more chlamydia episodes. However, the increased risk may be simple additive. Based on the best data we have so far, the study by Bakken et al., the risk of ectopic pregnancy in women with two or more episodes of chlamydia infection was roughly two times of that in women with one infection. All the studies of a repeat infection have limitations. The studies did not distinguish persistent infection from true new reinfections. We don't know whether or not the longer number of infection is simply a marker of longer cumulative duration of infection. The study results about PID may be positively biased because clinicians may be more likely to diagnose PID among women with a history of repeated chlamydia infection. At the same time, the study about ectopic pregnancy may be negatively biased because women with severe damage, tubal damage, will not have an ectopic pregnancy. They just simply do not get pregnant. Okay, so looking into the future, there's many gaps in knowledge remain. But I think the two areas is of critical importance. We need to better tools to measure PID and tubal damage. We need a standardized and innovative methods to measure both acute PID and a subclinical tubal involvement. Only with such tools, we can find out to what extent chlamydia infection may lead to long-term sequelae outside of the pathway involving symptomatic PID. We also need better studies on the natural history of the so-called repeated chlamydia infection. To distinguish true reinfection from those persistent infections that are repeatedly detected by repeated testing. To study the risk associated with true repeat infections, we must take into account the longer cumulative damage of infection from repeat episodes. Thank you.